From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 27th when presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke said it's time to ban the sale of AR-15s. O'Rourke is not calling for a confiscation of guns in this particular family, but he said, quote, "I just don't think we need to be selling more weapons into this public, more weapons of war into this public." That prompted a response from Fox News host Pete Hegseth, who said, quote, "Responsible gun owners recognize their right to own rifles like that. You can use weapons of war or assault ban all you like, but go out and get your second AR-15 today. Maybe it's a good day to do so," end quote. And all of that reminded me of what I had seen just days before on Twitter from former congressional candidate Nate McMurray. He was the candidate who nearly defeated incumbent Congressman Chris Collins in 2018. McMurray has remained very active in public conversations, and he has recently been vocal about his disappointment, not just with Republicans, but occasionally with Democrats from what we might call safe districts. McMurray sees political leaders trying to be safe, trying to avoid sensitive issues, sometimes like guns. And here's some of what Nate McMurray tweeted about guns. Quote, "Yep. I'm coming for your AR-15. You heard me. No apologies. The same reason you don't need a lion to protect your home is why you don't need a rifle that shoots at three times the speed of sound and splits concrete like ice. It's an unreasonable risk. End the mass shooter era in America. I will keep saying it. You don't need an assault weapon. We will make them illegal. We will not accept living in a nation where our schools and jobs are potential war zones. We will not be subject to corporate gun greed," end quote. And so I asked Nate McMurray to come back on Connections to discuss political boldness and risk-taking. And since his tweets about AR-15s, he says he's received numerous threats. He knows that kind of comes with the territory. We'll talk about a lot of that, too. He is currently the Grand Island supervisor for 4 more months as a town supervisor. And then after that, who knows? But he's here with us back on Connections. Nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back on.
I asked you before the program, and I'll ask you now. Are you going to break any news? Are you officially going to run for Congress again?
It's something I think about every single day, and obviously we had a lot of success last time. We didn't win, but we built a lot of ties and a lot of connections, and a lot of people are proud of what we did. So it's something I'm going to consider over the summer, and I'll have an announcement for you soon, I hope.
This is not like one of those cases, though, where everybody knows somebody's running, and then they say, "Join me Sunday at my private special announcement." What could it be? You're really wrestling with this. It's not a slam dunk.
No, there's a lot of paths open for me right now to do different things, and I know what it takes to run an NY27. I know every town. I know every bend. I know every creek. I went over that territory more than probably any candidate ever. And I love the region. I love the people of the region. I would love to represent them. But I have to evaluate all the options before me at this time and to see what's the best course, just not for me as a politician or a potential leader, but also for my family.
So to be clear, you know, for listeners who are wondering, you know, Nate is not a candidate. He may or may not run for Congress. But given his prominence in the district, the fact that he ran before, the fact that he might run again, we, of course, are reaching out to Chris Collins. It is a dream of mine to have Chris Collins on this program. I would love that. It has not happened so far. And we'll also reach out to other people who might consider runs for Congress in that same district. There's a lot of talk about someone like David Bellavia. We'll reach out to David, and I do suspect we might be able to arrange that conversation soon. By the way, do you know David Bellavia personally?
I do. I've been on his show several times.
Oh, I suspected you had, yeah.
I've talked to him numerous times, and you know, I think he's a much better candidate than Chris Collins. I'll put it that way.
Do you think he's going to be a candidate?
I don't know. He's run several times in the past. He has run on his own party. He created his own party previously. I know he's had some disputes with the Republican Party in the past, and he's been a talk show host advocating for ideas that are very different than the ideas I advocate for. And he'll have to represent those views, 10 years worth of those views. But I think the decision is a difficult decision for him, as it is for me, too.
There's a lot to consider. So, listeners, if you want to weigh in on what's going on in the district or what you want to see going forward, you can do that this hour if you want to call the program or if you want to email us, connections@wxxi.org, as we have a conversation with Nate McMurray this hour. And we expect to have a lot more conversations with the various people. Even if Chris Collins won't come on this program, I think Nate is correct to say that there very well could be either a primary or a challenge within the party. Though it does sound like the congressman thinks, you know, or wants to stay in that office for at least a while. Do you suspect he does?
Well, most people who are indicted are in office, they try to hold on as long as possible because that gives them more options with a potential deal or whatever else may come out. I will say this. We've been through this before. Last year when I was running, when he was indicted, there was this musical chairs scenario where some of the same people who want to run now came out of the woodwork and were considering running again. None of them ended up challenging him. So we're not sure exactly what will happen. They kind of all said, we're going to support him and we're going to get behind him previously. So we have to wait and see. But Mr. Collins himself, I think it's very unlikely that he'll step down. I think he has that one bargaining chip. It's the same thing I said when I was running against him, that he has this bargaining chip that he needs to hold on to, which is his position in Congress. And he does still have a lot of political power. Let's not forget how close he is to the president, and the president was supportive last time. So we'll have to see what happens.
Now, you lost that race by about 600 votes?
It was just a handful of votes. It was very, very as close as it gets.
0.27%, is that correct?
I think that is correct, yes. Yeah, one of the closest races in the country.
How often do you think about those numbers and you think, I didn't need 600 more votes, I just needed 301 more people to change their minds? In a district with, I mean, I don't know exactly how many people voted, but it was a big number.
Well, I mean, I take it the other way. We had tens of thousands of Republicans and independents vote for someone who was a very progressive candidate. I thought many people were shocked by that, including the National Party was very surprised by how well we did. I'm very proud of that. I think the people that were part of my campaign were proud of that. We turned a district that people thought was unwinnable, a red district, so-called red district, into a purple district. And that's because of the ideas I was representing, the ideas that every single American has a right to health care. We said it boldly. We said it proudly. Those are ideas that resonate with Americans today and Americans in this region, people who are struggling, people who know that we can do better in America.
Now, you know something about earning votes then in a district that's been pretty red. And I want to talk about some of that this hour. I want to talk about political risk-taking, the way we hear political leaders talk about what they want to do for the country. And I'm going to float an idea, and I want to kind of get your take on it here. Because we're right in the midst now of the endless presidential campaign. We've seen the first debates. And there's this idea in American politics that particularly for the presidency, but generally speaking, in a primary and then in a general election, you tack either hard left or hard right in the primary, and then you come to the middle in the general. And I don't know that that makes a whole lot of sense to me, and here's why. I don't understand how people run for office, particularly president, saying, you know, we're going to galvanize our base, we're going to beat the opposition, we're going to take them down, as opposed to saying, no, we're going to show people why, you know, they may distrust us, they may not like us, they may not like our party, but our views and our ideas are actually better for them. And once they see that as American workers, they're more likely to want to join us, not just because we took them out, we beat them, but because we said to them, look, whatever you've been told for a long time, that's not true. And here's why, if you're an American worker, what we want to do is better for you. That's generally not the kind of rhetoric we hear, though we hear some of it. We've heard it in the town halls recently from Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. But we generally don't hear that. It's much more polarized than that. Is that a problem?
Well, the polarization is a major problem. It's the reason why people like Mr. Collins can get elected, because people will look beyond clear faults or clear mistakes or just a lack of representation entirely.
Or corruption.
And corruption, and they'll vote for the candidate because they believe they have to hold on to the seat for their team. I think my position in politics, I mean, my background, I'm a corporate attorney and I'm a professional salesperson. I worked in development my entire life, large development deals. That's what I come from. That's what I was trained to do. I know how to do sales. To me, these ideas, the things I fight for, are more pure than that. And they're things I will not compromise. I do not look at what will win. I'm here to advocate for things I believe in. And it's my hope that the people that hear those ideas will also agree with it. Martin Luther King has a quote that I often repeat. It says that a leader does not follow consensus, it develops consensus, it builds consensus. It's a molder of consensus. And I believe that. I think far too often, the political consultants I've met and the political leaders I've met do the same thing over and over again. They say, that doesn't test well. That's not a policy that tests well. And I say, well, if I'm not here to fight for things that I believe in, what's the point of running at all? And that's kind of my position. I fight for what I believe in, what I believe is right, and I let the consequences follow.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because there's so much I want to ask you about since your near miss with Congress and what people are saying to you behind closed doors. But before we get there, when you ran and you would talk to Republicans, I remember when you came on this program, we had some left-leaning listeners who would say, you know, boy, you sound a little too friendly with Republicans or a little too acquiescent to their views or ideas. Occasionally, politics feels a little bit like blood sport and you want to knock out the other side. But when you would meet Republicans, and you met many, and you would talk to them. Sometimes they had a caricature of you, but when they met you in person, how did you try to at least show them that you were at least open to listening?
Well, as I've told you before, Evan, I come from, I'm one of seven. My mom raised us by herself. I'm a working class family. I worked my way through college. I worked my way through law school. So, I mean, I am not some strange character from a far off, I'm not from San Francisco, some strange liberal they can characterize as some outsider. I'm somebody from here. I'm a product of this region. And I share a lot of the values of the people of this region. At the same time, when I would talk to people, I would not break it down into a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. I'd say, don't you think, in a country with this much wealth, that every single person in the city of Batavia has a right to health care? And people would agree. Or I'd say, don't you think, in a country with this much gun violence, and with all the creativity we have and all the technology we have, we can't figure out better ways to protect the kids in our schools than just saying that we should give guns to our teachers? That's the best we can do, is arm more people. And generally, people will say, I agree with that. So I always have a common sense or practical perspective that I come to things with. And I think when you do that, and I have the opportunity to talk to people one-on-one, more often than not, these common sense or practical ideas are things that people relate to and believe in.
Maybe. All right, but let's talk a little bit about guns, because recently you tweeted that if more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world. We have a massive amount of guns per capita compared to the rest of the world, and we have a massive share of the gun-based violence compared to the rest of the world. But you will definitely meet people, and you have, who say, you know, I don't believe that. I own a gun because it keeps me safer. And you know, they push back on this idea. What do you do with that?
I agree with them that they say their gun, well, they have a right to defend themselves in their home. I have a gun. I'm someone who, an Eagle Scout, I grew up around guns. I am not afraid of guns. But I stood on that stage in downtown Buffalo when we had the March for Our Lives rally in front of thousands and thousands of young people. And I promised that we would fight to change the situation in America. And I'm going to keep that promise. And then recently, in front of my town hall in my small town, I said the same thing after a recent mass shooting. I said, we cannot continue to tolerate in this country the death of so many people by guns. And I said that, and there was some groans from some of the people in the audience, but afterwards, a lot of the high school students that were there, because they were there part of their school test, they came up and they thanked me. I think the younger generation will change this. And I will continue to be an advocate. I will not do what a lot of the politicians I've seen have done, which they took part of those marches, they were there when it was hot, and since then they have distanced themselves from these issues. I think there are...
You're talking about Democrats.
Oh, yes. Definitely talking about Democrats. We should all... We have the NRA on the ropes right now. This corrupt organization. Evan, we've seen in the news how corrupt they are, the things they do, the way they've wasted the members' money, the dues money. We've seen who they are. They're on the ropes. They're in disarray. And at this moment, we should be pushing, doubling down on making real change to protect our people. And I'm ready to do that.
But here is the kind of thing that I'm sure consultants will tell you you can't say. And I read it off the top, and I'll read it again. When you tweeted, yep, I'm coming for your AR-15. You heard me. No apologies. The same reason you don't need a lion to protect your home is why you don't need a rifle that shoots at three times the speed of sound and splits concrete like ice. It's an unreasonable risk. End quote. I'm sure consultants tell you that's too far. You cannot tell people I'm coming for your guns. Now, and that doesn't mean coming for all guns, but you're targeting specifically AR-15 and AR-15, sort of that family of guns, but they'll still tell you, you can't come for anyone's guns.
Evan, have you seen some of the feedback to that tweet?
The
racist, the hate-filled, the violent rhetoric that's in America today? If we're not willing to speak boldly about these issues and to say things strongly, we will never change the situation. We are taking knockout blows day after day after day on these issues. Knockout blows. We cannot look back and mince words and be afraid to say what we believe. What I believe is you do not need a weapon of war in your house. My next door neighbor, I recently visited him, or neighbor to my neighbor, not directly next door. I visited him. My child plays at his house, and he showed me his gun collection. And it was significant. And I said to him, why do you need all these guns in your house? It makes me uncomfortable to have my child in your house. And he said to me, just in case something goes down. I said, what is going to go down in our safe neighborhood? What, a zombie apocalypse? We're dealing with an unreasonable position that we need to push back against strongly. And if our leaders are not willing to do it, who is willing to do it? Right now, the people that we're putting up for to push back against this are our kids. We need to push back stronger ourselves.
What was some of that feedback? Because there were thousands of comments back. But I ask, you know, to tell me about some of it, because you have said, I think, that you got threats after that.
Well, you can look at the threats. Go look at the Facebook feed itself. I mean, they're evident. They weren't from here, Evan. They weren't comments from here. They're places from Alabama, from Arkansas. I wasn't getting a lot of comments from Albion. We're getting comments from around the country. Right now, we should understand that there's this alt-right, radical fringe element in America that we should take seriously, that is organized online, that will take positions, take people's identification and name and identity and put it online and make that person a target. You don't get that many comments overnight from NY27. You get those comments from a regional or a national or maybe even larger attempt to undermine and to attack an individual. And if I were to back off now, I would be cowardly. I need to continue to stand and say, we need to change this situation in America. Too many children have died. There's been too many mass shootings. There's too little has been done. And we need to go back and look at this and say, what can we do to make our kids safe? And I'm willing to do that.
In terms of firearm ownership, as you said, you're a gun owner yourself.
Yes.
You don't want to abolish gun ownership in this country.
No, I will go as far as to say, for decades and decades in this country, we had this militia theory of the Second Amendment. This modern theory, this recent court case that was decided in both of our lifetimes, that said there's this individual right to self-defense. I agree with that. I agree with that position. However, everything has to be balanced. And to have the type of firearms that we have today so readily available that have been used in Parkland, that had been used in Miami, and had been used in all these attacks across the country over and over again, if we're not willing to look at those guns and say, why do we need these in people's homes? Why are they so readily available? Why aren't we looking at technology to make it harder for them to be used by anybody who buys them? We're not doing our job. And we need to fight harder to make our kids safer.
But even the Democrats in political power in this country, with the strongest views on this, the vast majority will say things like, well, we don't need AR-15s. Let's grandfather it in. Let's pass legislation kind of like the SAFE Act that might not allow for transfer of ownership in the future, that or might limit the number that you can possess. That's different than saying, I'm coming for them. Like, I'm sorry, but you shouldn't have that in your house, and we're going to be a society that doesn't stand for it. That's different.
Well, things change, and we need to push forward for positions that things have changed. And look, if you look at the Democratic Party position from the 1960s, it would be considered absolutely extreme today, its position on gun control. Go back and look at it. There was literally efforts by many people in the Democratic Party to completely eliminate personal gun ownership once upon a time in America, not that long ago. I'm not even close to that. I just don't think you should have an AR-15 that does so much damage, that has hurt so many people in our country, that is so readily available, so in so many people's households. I think we need to take active steps to prevent that. And I think that's a very reasonable position, and I'll be willing to defend it. And listen, I will fight for what's right, not for what polls right, not for what polls well, but what is right for my family and for the families that I live around.
You said you put a little challenge out saying, I want someone, I'll buy an AR-15 off the first person to offer it, and I'll melt it down.
That's right.
Did anybody respond?
Of course not. No, they did not. But I would love to do it. Go ahead. If you have an AR-15 out there and you want to sell it to me, come on, sell it to me. I'll show you what it's used for. We should melt those things down. We need to look at a different way, a different approach to the way we look at firearms in our country.
But here's another thing that gun owners will often say to this. They'll say, well, you say this now that we'll stop at AR-15s. But once you have our AR-15s, what's next?
Evan, it's been the reverse slippery slope. Once upon a time in America, we had very practical approach up to gun ownership. No one had this type of firearm in their house. When Al Capone was running around shooting up people with Tommy guns, there was a reaction in our country to say, look, we can't keep Tommy guns in our house anymore. We outlawed those guns. There's been in the past reasonable responses to this. The difference is, in 1975, the NRA started lobbying, and they started putting money in politics. And today we see it all over politics. And so there's this fear to speak back. The slippery slope is not to removing guns from people. The slippery slope is that we want to put guns into every single person's hand in all across America.
Now, tell me what you say to, let's say it's a member of Congress, let's say it's a political consultant who's meeting with you privately. They're Democrats, and they say, you know what, Nate, privately, I agree with you. But here's the problem. If you say that, then you can't win an election. And if you can't win an election, you can't govern.
Well, this is the problem right now. You can win an election when you speak boldly. You can do that. People will grab. I have come to see firsthand that when you speak boldly and you have an authentic voice and you have an honesty to your voice, people will gravitate towards that. When I first said I wanted to have healthcare for every single American in NY27, people said I was crazy. Until I went to all these small towns across the region, people said, you're right. I can't afford my medical bills. This is crazy. My kid doesn't have access to his diabetes medication. If you speak with an honest and sincere voice and you fight for what you believe in, you can win, and we've proved that. I said these same ideas to you a year ago when I sat in this chair, and we came within a few hundred votes. We need to keep fighting for what we believe in. That's the only way we'll have real change in this country.
Here's the flip side of what some of your political opponents will say. They'll say, well, you came within a few hundred votes and you still couldn't beat a guy who was indicted.
I was willing to run against a guy who was indicted. I ran against a guy who was indicted before he was indicted because I knew he was corrupt. Because I knew there was a congressional ethics report out on him saying how corrupt he was. Now, I had the guts.
You didn't jump in after he was indicted at the point. No.
Exactly, right. like the other ones did. I got into that race when no one else thought I had a chance. The same thing that happened when I got into that race the first time, I came out and I said, someone has to stand up to Chris Collins. Did you read this ethics report? And everyone said, you can't run against Chris Collins. You're going to get crushed. You're going to get destroyed if you run against Chris Collins. At NY27, Nate, you have a good political future. Go somewhere else. Don't run in that district. I knew it was the right thing to do. And I ran against Chris Collins, and I knew it was the right thing to do, whether or not he was indicted. When he was indicted, everyone else jumped in. And the same situation is going on right now. People are saying, you cannot stand up to President Trump and his own party. How many Republicans have you met, Evan, that have told you can't stand up to this man? That is wrong, that there's nothing we can do. It's the way the party is. We have to stand with the party. You hear about all the comments that are happening in Congress among Republicans and in the Senate among Republicans, how they're embarrassed of him. We need people to say, not after the decision is made, not after the consensus is built, but to help mold that consensus. And that's what I'm going to do as long as I'm in politics.
Well, recently, the new chair of the Monroe County Republican Party on this program said that they may not like his personal conduct, but he's actually been a pretty good president, and things are much better than the media reports, that the economy's good, that people are feeling good, and that they want him reelected.
That gentleman, or is it a gentleman? He should be embarrassed. Because if you think this is the way our country should be run, if you think this type of divisiveness, if you've read the Mueller report and you still stand with the president, you are not fit for office yourself, if you want a bold statement. That man should be removed. And all of these people that are standing behind him or cozying up to them, history will not judge well.
Okay, but that's, again, in terms of boldness. We've seen the Democratic Party in particular waffle on impeachment. You're saying this is a president who should be removed. Democrats are saying we've got tens of millions of people who supported this president, who continue to support him, and they have no idea what kind of wound could be open if they proceed with a removal attempt.
The wound is open. Their wound is gaping. We need to ask people in this country right now, what would it take for us to take action against the president? What action would he have to take? How much would he have to ignore the law? What type of behavior would justify an impeachment hearing? I think if you're at the point now where you're looking at this man and you're still saying it's justified not to take action against him, or that he is not a threat to our country, or he is not a national security threat, then you're just not paying attention. Evan, leadership is about being a leader. We need people in our party and in both sides of the party to lead and say this man is not fit to be president.
There are a number of Democrats who say we've got the chance. 2020 election's coming. That's your chance to impeach him.
With the election?
Yeah. Remove him from office.
I can tell you right now, we opened up impeachment hearings. If you look back at the impeachment hearings against Nixon, the threat of impeachment or the investigations themselves eroded his support. When those hearings were held and people saw what type of behavior he was engaged in, which I believe our current president is engaged in more significant behavior, you saw his poll numbers decline because they helped build the consensus against him. We need our leaders now to build that consensus once again.
When it comes to boldness and decisions and where you're meeting people who disagree, how do you feel about the debate within Democratic Party leadership about going on Fox News?
I believe Fox News has become a propaganda arm of very radical ideas in this country. I believe they should not support Fox News.
But true or not, you've got millions of people, especially in rural, old industrial towns, and that's all they see. And let's just take Nate McMurray. If they're hearing about a congressional race, they may get what you think is a caricature of you. And if you don't go on to counter that, what do you do about that?
You're making a good point. But the problem is, are you going to get a lot of those votes anyway? I mean, there's people, if people who are addicted to Fox News.
Well, you said you're changing minds.
You can change minds for certain, but when you have, there's a certain level you have to look at and say, am I giving them credibility by going on their program? And if I think you, if you look at the nightly performances on that station currently, it is beyond what is normal in America, what has been normal in the past, and what is reasonable.
So why should people who have what they would call traditional conservative values vote? And again, I'm not talking to you as a candidate. I don't know if you're going to run again. But I'm talking about candidates and people like you who hold the values you hold. Why should conservatives think about you?
Evan, I grew up watching William F. Buckley, thinking how, you know, I didn't agree with a lot what he said, but I thought he was this charming, eloquent speaker, right? And this engaging personality. You know, I grew up, I went to law school. I studied the works of people like Edmund Burke. I'm someone who is very familiar with conservative thought and what conservative thought means. I grew up in a very conservative religious background. I'm someone who is familiar with conservative ideology. If you think what is being advocated for from the White House today represents traditional conservatism in America, you're wrong. This is something very, very different and something that's very, very dangerous.
In our second half hour, we're going to take some feedback from listeners. If you want to call the program, you can do that toll-free. 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. My guest for the hour is Nate McMurray, who ran for Congress a year ago and came within about 600 votes of defeating incumbent Chris Collins in what has traditionally been a very red district. He doesn't know if he's going to run again, or if he does, he hasn't announced it yet. Maybe before the end of the hour, we'll break some news with Nate. But the point is, he says he is considering another run for Congress. He's also considering other options. And we'll take some of your feedback. Want to know if you agree with some of the way he thinks about politics, the idea that if you take bold stances that either seem extreme or polarizing, that you can't win. He says boldness and conviction is what brings people together. And we're going to talk more about that after our only break of the hour with Nate McMurray. Coming up in our second hour, Lake Effect Magazine celebrates 25 years in business. And if you've never heard of it, well, they're telling the kinds of stories that they hope will get your attention. We're going to talk to some of the women that they have chosen to feature in their 25th anniversary issue. We're going to talk about these inspiring stories, stories of hardship, struggle, perseverance, and overcoming the odds. Next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nate McMurray founded Fight Like Hell online. Fightlikehell.us?
We did. We have that website up.
And, you know, it's the kind of idea that you want people to kind of join a movement. Have you really heard from people who are on all sides of the political aisle since your race?
Sure. We've had training events for candidates across the district. We've had, I mean, if you look at, remember, I'm a small town supervisor. If you look at the type of support we get for the ideas that I'm advocating for, which you keep labeling as extreme. I'm telling you, they're not extreme.
I don't intend to label them extreme. I'm talking about how politics traditionally will box them.
Well, I think if you're talking about a traditional politician who stands up with a suit and looks like a cardboard figure and says, I'm going to do exactly what the guy behind me tells me to do, yes, I'm never going to be that guy. I do not want to be that guy. But what if you're talking about a guy who talks about practical solutions like reasonable gun control, keeping weapons of war out of people's houses, standing up to a president who consistently violates the law, finding ways that everyone in America can have health care in the richest country in the world, I think those are very practical and reasonable approaches. Sorry, what's your
name? No. Let me just put a fine point on this before we go to phone calls here. I'm not actually all that comfortable with the word extreme anyway when we talk about policy, because let's say you are a conservative and you think universal health care is extreme. You would probably also think that taking the top marginal tax rate from 39 or 36% down to 4% is extreme, but that's a good kind of extreme. I don't think extreme really works. It scares people. I think policy proposals are policy proposals, and they should be evaluated on the merits.
Again, I'm a dad with two kids and a Ford who likes to fish and kayak. I don't think I'm extreme. I'm someone who's bold and is going to fight for what I believe in. And that Fight Like Hell program that we used, it really got a lot of people involved, and we're going to have to keep using it or keep finding ways to keep people involved, because I want more voices in politics. I want less cardboard figures. I want real people, people who work real jobs involved in the political process.
All right, let's go to your phone calls. Eric and Honeyway, first up with Nate McMurray. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you for taking my call, Evan. My first comment is a general respect for your guest, because he is not being shy at all with speaking his mind and taking stances. I also agree with you, Evan, that he is unelectable with that type of a stance. I think that he really needs to focus more on the healthcare focus, things that are going to be helping the general population of this country. I think that as a Democrat, if he wants to stand up against President Trump, that will win him a lot of votes. I think that this country is still several generations away from melting down AR-15s, but I will be the first one to raise my hand and let him know that I still have the receipt, and if he would like to pay me what I paid, he can have it, because the SAFE Act in New York made it pretty much worthless. Those are my comments.
All right, Eric, thank you. I appreciate that. So first of all, Nate McMurray, there may be your first person willing to sell you back an AR-15. So I would just tell Eric, if he wants to email you or get in touch with you via website, how does he do it?
I'm all over social media. Eric, first of all, thanks for your kind words. I appreciate you saying that at the very least. What will it take for us to take it seriously, the threat of the AR-15? How many more mass shootings do we have? I encourage people to listen to. It's difficult to listen to. Go back and listen to the tape of that shooting in Las Vegas. Listen to the sound of that rifle, the pop of that rifle, and realize that this is the greatest country in the history of the world. We should not be afraid to go to concerts. I hired, as a supervisor of my small town, police officers to help guard our school. I still don't feel safe about it. I don't feel safe about any of our schools in this country. Do we have to turn every movie theater into a camp? Do we have to turn every school into a camp? When are we going to say that gun that he doesn't even like, that he wants to sell to me to melt down, isn't worth all of this trouble?
A couple of things here. To kind of clarify, Eric, I'm not saying Nate McMurray is unelectable. I'm saying that consultants will absolutely say if you take bold stances, it may make you unelectable. Consultants are the people who write every ad that looks exactly the same, every, you know, soft-focused political spot you've ever seen. It's the same kind of language. They like to say controversial things like believe in America. I don't really know. Like, it's not very popular to say don't believe in America. Consultants are pretty risk-averse. That's what I'm saying.
Look, at again, I think there's more people that agree with what I'm saying than you think, Evan. And I think that in America today, people are looking for the type of change that I'm advocating for. I think whether I'm electable or not, we'll have to see. Time will tell. I think that in the last election, people thought I didn't have a chance. I think we did better than other candidates that have been indicted in other elections in the past, or other candidates like the Duncan Hunter election. We did much, much better advocating for these very same ideas. I think that a lot of people are gravitating towards me today because I'm willing to take a stand. And I think that's the purpose of politics, that we're going to fight for what we believe in. If you want just some random guy off the street who's going to say whatever the political consultants tell him to say, yes, please don't vote for me.
Yeah, look, Nate McMurray is electable. Chris Collins is electable. David Bellavia might be electable. There's a lot of people who might be electable. I'm simply talking about the fact that Nate McMurray speaks in a way that is different than what you hear a lot of people who run for office, who are in office. And the reason is often because of the homogenization that starts with consultants. That's all. That's the observation. And either the consultants are right, and Nate's got a hard road, or Nate's right, and we're going to see something different. Maybe producer Megan Mack can help me find a piece. There was a piece recently, I think in The Atlantic, but I don't know, about how Democrats over the last 30, 40 years have been scarred by political losses and are afraid of risk. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, if I can say, yeah, we can definitely look. This is a different era. I mean, obviously, I'm not a fan of President Trump. But he has definitely changed politics in America for better and for worse. I think in a good side, we're not in the era of the Howard Dean where you make one gaffe and you're out. But we're in an era where people can speak boldly. Now, that's brought a lack of civility, but it's also brought a certain level of honesty. I wish more of the Democrats and more of the Republicans on both sides said what they really believed about President Trump, what they really believed about these issues, so we could have an honest debate. If you think I'm bold, go back and read the letters from the Founding Fathers, how they talked about each other, how they talked about their issues they believed in. They were bold advocates many times more than I am today.
At least someone like Eric, who may or may not vote for you, knows where you are. There's a real benefit for voters knowing who you are and not thinking that you're triangulating. Because right now, a lot of people in both major parties do a lot of triangulating. That's just the way politics works. Linda in Webster is next on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, Nate. It's so good to hear your voice on WXXI.
Thank you for saying that.
And this is in regard, you're welcome. And this is in regard to the neighbor, the story you told about the neighbor and the guns, and our recent caller who had an AR-15, which he does not think is worth anything. So my, because this is still a free country, I'm just going to, you know, throw my opinion out there. The bold thing that we, that Democrats have to do is to have a conversation. And I know in the moment when you saw all your neighbors' guns lined up in the closet and all that, I'm sure that, you know, there was, I would have had emotional whiteout myself. And to ask that person, you know, he said, well, I think blah, blah, blah is going to go down. Well, what's going to go down? Okay, how do you know this? And if the person's story is that his house was broken into, somebody had a gun, threatened his family, I don't still agree with his stance of having all those guns, but I can get where he's coming from. I can get where he's coming from. And I guess my point is to have that bold conversation. And, I mean, I know that you have those conversations because I met you in person and all of that. I think it's Democrats in general, no matter what office, we got to have the bold conversations because we can certainly fight like hell, and I agree with you, and it's, you know, to have values and all of that. And at the same time, we cannot promote the same sort of partisanship and polarization that is going on in this country. I guess that's my thought.
Linda, thanks for the phone call.
Linda, listen, you make some great points, and I agree with you so much in many ways. We don't want to have a situation where we're needlessly screaming at each other all the time. But at the same time, if we're not willing to stand firm for things we believe in, what's the point? Again, I'm going to go back to this President Trump issue. We can sit here and say, well, look, we don't want to hurt the country. We don't want to wound the country. It's wrong. He violated the law. The Mueller report is crystal clear on this issue. When do we say, okay, it's time to take a stand? So you always work for consensus. That's the goal, is consensus. But we have to stop, people that are on the progressive side of the aisle, have to stop saying that we are willing to bend just to keep the room quiet, just to keep the just to keep things copacetic. We need to find ways to get along, of course, but we cannot bend on our values.
Susan writes to us to say, conservatives tend to vote for the candidate on their team, regardless of who he is or whether he is being indicted because of social issues. Whether he is being indicted. They vote this way because of social issues such as abortion and gay rights. How do you reach people on issues like that?
Remember, if we would have had the position that we just need to drop gay rights, or we need to drop abortion, or we need to not talk about those things 20, 30 years ago, think about where we'd be today. In my lifetime, no issue has changed more than the fact that we are becoming a more inclusive society of LGBTQ plus issues. And that happened because of fierce advocacy, an unwillingness to bend, an unwillingness to compromise our true core values. You compromise on issues that you can work together on, but on those core values, you do not compromise. And I think if you look at the way that issue has changed and how accepting there is, the acceptance that has grown across our country, I think that's a great example of how we can fight for other issues in this country.
So there are some places where you got to play ball, you got to compromise, but there's some where you put your foot in the sand and you say that's
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you some of the ones for me. I will not compromise on a woman's right to choose. I will not compromise my position on health. We need every single American to have health care. And I will not compromise on equality issues. And I will add, I will not compromise on this issue of the Second Amendment. We need to protect the Second Amendment, but we also need to find ways to make our kids safe. And we can do that. Again, I stood on that stage in that March for Our Lives rally. I saw the thousands and thousands of kids in the audience and the thousands and thousands of kids in the streets who said, we can do better. We will do better. We will not forget. And here we are 2 years later thinking about ways to make people with AR-15s happy. That's wrong.
Do you think it's a moral problem for someone in this country to have $1 billion?
No. This is an issue I love talking about, capitalism. I'm a capitalist. I believe in the capitalist system. I believe the capitalist system is broken. The capitalist system, there's this idea out there somewhere in the wilderness, there's a free market. If we can just let that free market free, it's going to solve all our problems for us. But the reality is we create the market through our laws, through our rules, through the way we regulate how we interact with each other. There's all kinds of laws that we have on the books. For example, you can't contract with me to sell me your kidney. It's illegal. We have laws. That's part of the free market. Bankruptcy laws are part of the free market. We have these laws in the system. We have created a capitalist system today that is completely warped and broken that benefits a very small percentage of the people. I'm for true capitalism, not the type of crony capitalism we have today. Capitalism that engages more people. Capitalism that gives labor the right to negotiate. You have a completely one-sided system. Let me say this. Every single corporation in America has a fleet of lobbyists and lawyers that they hire to shape the free market, the so-called free market. We need our politicians and our leaders to shape the free market for the people out there that don't have someone fighting for them.
Well, on the subject of compromise, let me read from a piece in the Washington Post, and producer Megan Mack grabs it for me, titled Haunted by the Reagan Era. And it's a piece about how Democrats are often gun-shy, maybe that's a strange term to use in the context of this conversation, but hesitant to really go after what they boldly believe in because they're fearful that if they are anything but considered a moderate or a centrist, that they can't win. I'm going to quote from the piece. Newly elected Democrats in the House of Representatives spent June 27th with the sinking feeling that it was happening again. Their party was going to cave to President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on a viscerally emotional issue. Just after a searing photo circulated of a father and his young daughter who had drowned in each other's arms while fleeing for the sanctuary of U.S. shores, Democrats in Congress let a GOP-drafted spending bill go through that did nothing to address conditions for detained immigrant children, abandoning a House version that would have ordered improvements. House leaders blamed Senate Democrats for capitulating. Senate Democrats attacked the House for poor negotiating. End quote. Was that a failure, and should that have been a line in the sand?
Listen, I don't know the full context or details of that, but I think your broader point about that era and a strong desire to move to a moderate position, I think there's some truth to that. I also think there's some truth to say that this partisan divide, left-right divide, makes less and less sense today. I think that people on both sides of the aisle have belief systems and ideas that are broad, that don't exactly fit into any cookie-cutter scenario. And I think we have to find more options for a different and diverse expression of those ideas. I think sometimes this partisan divide leads to consensus thinking and groupthink.
All right, more feedback here. Phil says, I live in Mendon, a very conservative part of NY27, but in my estimation, becoming less so. I could not agree more wholeheartedly with Mr. McMurray and his approach. Democrats need this honesty and fearlessness.
Thank you, sir. I'm with you.
Sean says, Evan, I wanted to offer some points that I find are always missing in the gun debate. I find my points on this issue are usually dismissed by both sides, as they tend to be more middle of the road, and no one these days really likes that. In any case, I am frustrated that the argument against guns always focuses on shootings involving AR-15 variant rifles. The number of gun deaths in this country involving this rifle don't represent a majority or even plurality of the deaths. In fact, being that this rifle and its variants are the most common rifle in the U.S., it seems strange that there aren't more involved in shootings. The reason I find this troubling is that we don't seem to give any press to the vast majority of shootings that happen in our very city, done by handguns, for the most part, many of which are illegal. If you can find a politician who wants to prioritize gun laws based on the actual statistical danger of the gun, I'd welcome that. Until that happens, I have a very hard time getting behind arguments like this.
What's this young man's name? Sean. Sean, you make a great point. Handguns are the most dangerous weapon as far as criminal statistics go, but they're not used by often in these mass shootings because of obvious reasons. But let me talk about handguns for a second. Let's figure out ways to make them safer. Now, look at my phone here. It requires my face or my passcode to get into. My house requires my passcode to get into. My computer requires my passcode to get into. You're telling me we can't create a technology that makes sure only the permit holder is able to use that firearm? Now, again, I'm not saying that's exactly the right approach, but there's a million approaches we can go forward with. If you ask the NRA, any regulation whatsoever is a egregious violation of the Second Amendment and wrong. Now, when you have a country with how many hundreds of thousands of people have died in the last 5 years from either suicide or shooting or some other form of firearm abuse, It's ridiculous. Our numbers are completely off the charts. We need to start having creative discussions like Sean's talking about to figure out a way to decrease gun violence in our country.
Okay, but setting aside that, he's right to say that AR-15s and related weapons are not at all anything close to a majority or plurality of gun deaths, but they are certainly involved in many of the mass shootings.
Correct.
And in your view, setting aside handguns and handgun-related deaths, you think it is simply unacceptable that weapons like that, that are created for the purpose of killing a lot of people quickly, ought to be in the hands of civilians.
And marketed for the purpose of creating. Look, if you really boil this down and you really push people on this argument, what do they come back with? The same argument every single time. They want these guns for a right of insurrection. Now, let that sit with everybody out there. They think because the revolutionary happened with militias and people with guns in their house, that we should maintain that right and there should be this safety mechanism in our society that this average guy with a couple AR-15s in his garage, like the guy I talked about in my neighborhood, should have the right, in case anything goes down, to take on the United States government. Now, does that seem reasonable to anybody listening? That this guy in my neighborhood is going to be able to take down the United States government? I mean, that's essentially what the argument comes down to. If you keep pushing on it. Listen to what I'm saying. I'm saying you should have a right to defend your home. You should have an individual right to self-defense. You should have a right to have a firearm. We need creative ways to make those firearms safer, and we need to limit access to an amount that's reasonable to these most dangerous firearms that are used in these mass shootings. That is a very reasonable position.
All right, a few more comments from listeners. Mary Lynn says, hello, Evan. I'm a registered Republican here in the far more purple than red 27th Congressional District.
Right on.
I hope you run again, Mr. McMurray. Honey, I Fall supported you last time, and you represent my values.
I love the town. I love you guys. Thank you so much.
Anne says, in Pittsford, I'm a mother of a 7-year-old. We lived 20 minutes from the Parkland shooting in Florida until last year. I am thrilled your guest is willing to talk about common sense gun control. It is refreshing to hear somebody willing to protect my child.
Don't give up. Keep fighting.
Let me grab real quick one more phone call. This is Bill in Rush. Got to keep it tight, Bill. Go ahead.
Guns is just a big amount of noise which is hiding the real problem. The real problem is money. And the people who have money have taken away regulations that make sense for most of us regular people. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected in 33 and took office in March of 34. You had a very long window of lame duck. A man named Ferdinand Pecora, a Sicilian from New York, someone thought with no possibility of doing anything, went in, got all the information on the 29 stock market crash, and took down the head of Citibank within a few days. Mr. Pecora became the head of the SEC when FDR took office. So that was the beginning of the Securities Exchange Commission. And oh, by the way, he used radio, the new unregulated medium of the time, to get the head of Citibank out of office. And that also was the point when we got the Glass-Steagall Act and the federal communications laws of 1934 that said people could have not a large influence in politics. It led to the Fairness Act and a bunch of other stuff. There were all regulations put in after the banks and rich people did a very big disservice to this country by pretty much taking lots of money from people who are regular. And back then, because of the lack of ability for people to create their own groundswell and create splinter movements, we just had a depression. They didn't have the banking regulations. They didn't have anything in place to take care of us regular people. And all this stuff you see with guns and all the stuff you see is directly connected to the fact that in 1996, we got rid of Glass-Steagall. We got rid of the Communications Act. We got rid of the Fairness Act.
So we got rid of
a lot of stuff.
Let me just jump in, Bill, because our time is going to be short. Go
ahead, Dave. Bill, listen, Bill from Rush, I am 100% with you. I've been asked a lot about guns on the show today, but you're right. If what really motivates me, more than anything else is the wealth divide in this country. I tell my team, the people I worked with in the last election every single day, that's what drives me to do this. I'm someone who, again, I grew up in poverty. For a long time, I was embarrassed of my background because I tried to hide it because it was painful for me to talk about the way we grew up. And then I fought and I got into the room with a lot of more people with a lot more wealth than me. And I saw how they did not understand how most Americans live. and the trials and tribulations that most Americans are going through. And I think if you look at the way the system is set up, and I know it well, having worked in it myself and having studied in law school and gone through this process and been given a lot of privileges other people don't have, this divide needs to end or else our country is not going to work any longer. And if I get into office, I promise everyone listening there, I am going to fight first and foremost for working class people, the type of people that I love, the type of people that I represent, and the type of people I come from.
Sounds like you're running for Congress.
We'll see.
He has not said specifically, and so let's close with this. I'm sure you've had offers or ideas about doing other things. For 4 more months, you're the mayor of Grand Island, or the supervisor of Grand Island. And then, 30 seconds, what else is possibly on the plate for you? What are you thinking about?
I mean, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm looking at everything right now. I'm looking at a lot of different options. I do not want to lose my voice in politics. I think the voice is unique. And if that sounds arrogant, I apologize to the listeners, but I think that a lot of people are not out there saying the things I'm saying. And I would love to run at NY27 again. I'm not going to lie. I love this region. I love traveling around it. I love seeing people. I love going to the local ice cream shops. I learned to love in every single town around this region. But I need to do what's going to allow me to continue to fight for hope in this country and continue to fight for the America that I love.
When do you think you'll make a decision by?
I'm going to think about it this summer and make a decision by the end of the summer.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for everyone listening.
And Nate makes an important point. We talked somewhat about guns this hour, but it's really about political ideas and boldness and conviction. And there's a lot more to talk about with him, whether he runs or not. There's also plenty of room on this program to talk to Republicans from that district who may be running. We're going to reach out possibly to, we'll see if David Bellavia, who I don't know anything about, whether he'd run again, but we'll talk to him. We'll see if Chris Collins wants to come on as well. That's Nate McMurray joining us again in Connections. More coming up.